Thank you very much. Thank you. And a very big thank you to Alison and Peter for hosting this. It's really wonderful and wonderful to be here. And it seems, you know, it's even worth coming down from the north sometimes. You know, they do have nice weather down here. So, just a word or two, first of all. The title of this talk is In Search of St. Cuthbert. And during the talk, I'm going to be, first of all, explaining my own interest in it, and then having a look at the life of St. Cuthbert himself through the eyes of his most famous biographer, the Venerable Bede. And my assistant in this is the Venerable Bede at my side here, who will be reprising the words of Bede in a Sydneysider accent, which is a little known fact about the Venerable Bede. So that'll be the first part of the talk, is really about St. Cuthbert himself. The second part will move on a couple of hundred years to a time of intense political and spiritual crisis in the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, to the time of King Alfred, when the Danes were invading, not just for a bit of light rape and pillage, but actually to take over the kingdom, and what happened then to St. Cuthbert and his relics. And finally, we will perhaps reflect a little about what St. Cuthbert might mean for us today, what the place of a 7th century saint might have in our lives. So if I can start by saying a little bit about my own relationship with St. Cuthbert. As Alison said, I grew up in Northumbria, not far from Lindisfarne, the holy island of St. Cuthbert. And when you grow up in that part of the country, you're always near St. Cuthbert. The local name for him is Cuddy. And I knew that Eider ducks were Cuddy's ducks, because when he was in his hermitage on the Farne Island, they gave the down from their breasts to warm him, and he forbade their killing on his island. And we knew that when you went to Holy Island, you had to look for Cuddy's beads, which could only be found by the pure in heart. And I'm pleased to say there are several round my neck just now. They're actually fossils, little crinoids, but they can be threaded as rosary beads, and they were supposed to be St. Cuthbert's rosary. So Cuddy's beads, Cuddy's ducks, and I was sent away to boarding school in the Scottish Borders, and it was organised into four houses, Ninian, Columba, Kentigern and Cuthbert, and I found myself in St. Cuthbert's house. So there is a kind of a relationship with Cuthbert that goes back a long way for me, but he was always a legendary figure, as he is really, in that part of Northumberland. And what really changed my interest in him was a day in London when I was due to catch the 2 o'clock out of King's Cross, which for all livers in the northeast is where we get our train from to go up to Berwick. And I was early for the 2 o'clock, and I decided that I would visit what was then the new British Library, because I knew that the Lindisfarne Gospels had been housed there. And so I went there to have a look at the Lindisfarne Gospels, and they are very beautifully and wonderfully displayed there in a dark room, fully illuminated, and they really are a stunning and wonderful sight, which I commend to you if you haven't seen them. As well as the Gospels, they have some relics that were taken from St. Cuthbert's coffin when it was opened in Victorian times. And there are because I understand from Alison the pectoral cross has been moved. There were three objects. His pectoral cross from his time as bishop, a beautifully inlaid topaz pectoral cross. His travelling altar, a small folding altar that he took with him when he travelled through Northumbria, evangelising to the people. And his own copy of the St. John Gospel. It's just a small, battered brown book, And it was his copy, one of the earliest books we have, of the St John Gospel. And wonderful though the Lindisfarne Gospels were, I found that what really made the impression on me was these three objects. The sense that these are things that he had used. He had read from the St John Gospel just as we do. That he had worn the cross, he had used... And suddenly he became a real person to me, instead of a legendary figure. It was like meeting him in the street, and he became real to me. And I came out of the British Library with a very clear intention in my mind to find out more about St Cuthbert, and to find out who this person had been. Now, for many of the saints of that period, because it was an extraordinary period, the 7th century, for saints in the north of England, but many of them we know very little about. By contrast, we know a great deal about St Cuthbert, and that's because of his most famous biographer, the Venerable Bede. And so just before we talk about Cuthbert, I'll say a word or two about the Venerable Bede. Bede was a monk at the famous Anglo-Saxon monastery of Jarrow, which is near the Tyne, and there was a twin monastery, Mount Wearmouth. He wasn't quite a contemporary of Cuthbert's. He was 14 when Cuthbert died, and he never knew Cuthbert. Bede was taken to the monastery as a very young child. When he was still a child, there was plague that swept through his monastery, and only he and another monk survived. So he was a tough one, was Bede. And for the rest of his life, he was a scholar. He never travelled more than 2 miles from Jarrow, but he wrote some biblical commentaries that are still used today. He wrote a complete history of the Anglo-Saxon people and church, which is still extant. And because of a very extraordinary event, he came to write a history of St Cuthbert. So back to St Cuthbert. When he died, he was already revered by the people, and they had begged him to be allowed to bury his remains in the church on Lindisfarne, where he had been a bishop. And he had agreed to this, and he was buried in a stone coffin near the altar. 11 years after his death, because there was so much interest from pilgrims coming, the monks took the decision to open the coffin and to rehouse his remains in a reliquary box, a light wooden coffin, so that he could be approached more easily by pilgrims. And when they opened the coffin, something extraordinary happened. And this is how Bede describes that event.
On opening the coffin, they found the body completely intact, looking as though still alive, and the joints and the limbs still flexible. It seemed not dead, but sleeping. The vestments, all of them, were not merely unfaded, but crisp and fresh like new, and wonderfully bright. The monks were filled with great fear and trembling.
So they found the body uncorrupt, and this was the next best thing to finding him resurrected. It was a complete miracle, and this established Cuthbert as definitely a first order saint. And pilgrimage started to increase, stories of his miracles abounded, and it was clear that they needed an authoritative account of his life, a hagiography. And Bede, by this time, 25, an established scholar, was the go-to writer for such a history. And so Bede embarked on his history of St Cuthbert. And he had a good relationship with the monks on Lindisfarne, some of whom had actually known Cuthbert and were able to tell him about. And he embarked in a very thorough, scholarly, Bede-like way on producing the history of St Cuthbert. He tells us how he went about his task.
I have written nothing about the saint, without first subjecting the facts to the most thorough scrutiny. Indeed, before even ever beginning to write, I carried out a thorough investigation of the whole of the saint's glorious life, with the help of those who had actually known him. I occasionally mention some of their names in the body of the book, so that you can see for yourself exactly what the sources are.
So we have Bede here claiming his academic rigour, really, that he's checked his sources and this is true. So we have to ask ourselves, how reliable a witness is Bede? It's a very lively history, and he hasn't hesitated to dramatise. And there are lots of passages of dialogue. For example, there's one incident where Cuthbert meets the abbess of Whitby in a boat in the middle of the North Sea. They were just those two there. But Bede doesn't hesitate to record their entire conversation verbatim. So there is a little bit of imagination going on. It's also an account that's full of miracles. And some of the miracles bear quite close resemblance to gospel miracles. For example, there's a case where Cuthbert is met by a sheriff, and on being told that his wife is sick, he cures his wife in absentia, as a fairly direct parallel of one of the gospel miracles. So it's a fiction in some ways, but it does give us a wonderfully authentic feel for Cuthbert's life and for the fabric of Anglo-Saxon life in the 7th century. There's just so much ordinary detail about everyday life that brings the period to life for us in a quite new way. And I think that just the last thing to say, for example, in Cuthbert's deathbed speech, there is a fairly extensive homily that is a fairly accurate reflection of Bede's theological position. So again, we can't tell for sure what Cuthbert thought, but we do have the impressions of a lot of his contemporaries. So it is a very wonderful source, and it's terribly readable. You think in a 7th century monk this is going to be really hard work, but it's not. I really commend it to you. It's wonderful reading, the Venerable Bede. So, on to Cuthbert's life. Cuthbert was born in 634. We don't know exactly where, somewhere in the borders. There is a story of him as a shepherd, but it seems more likely that he came from a relatively aristocratic background. He refers to his foster mother, and it was the practice at that time for well-born boys to be given to a foster mother. And when he turns up at Melrose to enter the monastery there, he arrives on a horse with a spear and gives these to an attendant, which suggests that he wasn't a churl from the fields. And it also suggests he may have had some military training. He was said to be a very robust, strong, vigorous man. And whatever called him to the monastery, we don't know. He is said to have seen a vision of St. Aidan's soul ascending to heaven accompanied by angels, and this inspired him. St. Aidan was the first evangelist of Northumbria, who came from Iona, from the great Celtic monastic tradition, and we'll see later that this was to cause some problems. So he served his novitiate under a very saintly abbot called Boisil at Melrose. When he was 21, he was sent to a new monastery at Ripon, and he took up the post of guest master, which is quite an interesting post for him to have had. We're told that he was a very pleasant, affable man. And being given that job as guest master suggests to us that he was someone who was good with people, who liked people. He also entertained angels on some occasions. About 7 years later, there was the start of a political upheaval that was going to become more acute when the Roman side of the monastic tradition took over Ripon, and Cuthbert went back to Melrose. When he arrived at Melrose, he found that his abbot, Boisil, was close to death. And Bede describes for us what happened between the two men.
Boisil told him, "Death is upon me. By next week, my body and voice shall have lost their strength." Cuthbert knew he was telling the truth. "Then tell me, what is the best book to study? One that can be got through in a week?" "St. John the Evangelist," Boisil answered. "I have a commentary in 7 parts. With the help of God, we can read one a day and perhaps discuss it if we want." It was done as he said. They were able to finish quickly because they dealt not with the profound arguments, but with the simple things of the faith that works by love. On the 7th day, when the reading was finished, illness overtook Boisil, and he entered into the joy of eternal bliss. He is believed to have unfolded all Cuthbert's future during that week. He was a prophet and a very holy man.
It's a lovely extract that they read from the heart, and again, the St. John Gospel, which seems to have held a particular resonance and importance to these monks. On Boisil's death, Cuthbert became the prior of Melrose and served there for the next 7 or 8 years. And during this time, we see that aspect of Cuthbert that perhaps is represented by the travelling altar, that he became an evangelist and travelled in his role as prior throughout the wild hills and valleys of Northumbria. It was just such an interesting time, this, in Northumbria. These were a pagan people. They worshipped pagan idols, very close to the Norse religions. And yet, within the space of a few generations, Northumbria was converted to Christianity. And it was a completely peaceable conversion. The king had invited the missionaries, but there was no political pressure. It was done purely through conversion and by incredibly dedicated monks with a very strong vision. And Bede gives us an account of Cuthbert going out to preach in the hills and valleys.
"During the plague, some of the people had fled to idols, as though incantations or amulets or any other diabolical rubbish could possibly avail against a punishment sent by God the Creator. To bring back these sinners, he often did the rounds of the villages, sometimes on horseback, more often on foot, preaching the way of truth to those who had gone astray. He made a point of searching out those steep, rugged places in the hills which other preachers dreaded to visit because of their poverty and squalor. This to him was a labour of love. He was so keen to preach that sometimes he would be away for a whole week or a fortnight or even a month, living with the rough hill folk, preaching and calling them heavenward by his example."
So we have Cuthbert the preacher, the evangelist. The next big event in Northumbrian terms came in 664 with the Synod of Whitby, when the confrontation between the Roman Church, the Roman branch of Christianity, and the Celtic branch of Christianity came to a head. The Celtic monasticism was tribal in structure and individualistic in terms of its abbots setting down the order that their monks followed. The Roman tradition was much more structured, hierarchical, diocesan-based. And there were certain flashpoints that, like all theological controversies, seem quite obscure in retrospect. The controversies were around the tonsure, how the monks tonsured themselves, and the celebration of Easter. The Roman tonsure had a little crown of thorns, and it's not quite clear what the Celtic one was, whether it was a sort of rough in the middle or shaving right across. We're not quite sure, but anyway, it was a hot topic. And Easter was a hot topic too, because at the royal court, the king had married a princess from Kent who'd been brought up in the Roman tradition, and she and her courtiers would be celebrating Easter 2 or 3 weeks ahead of the king, who was still undergoing the Lenten fast. So it created a lot of muddle in terms of calculating Easter. And so the king said, we're going to have a synod, we're going to sort this out once and for all. Coleman, the bishop of Lindisfarne, came down and argued passionately for the Celtic tradition, and Wilfrid, a very controversial figure, argued equally passionately for the Roman tradition. And he won the day. He said, and the king said, if Peter keeps the gates of heaven, then it is to the Roman tradition that we should adhere if we want to get in. So that swung it. Coleman went back to Lindisfarne, took several, at least a dozen of his monks and left, and went to Ireland, founded a new monastery. And so a new bishop of Lindisfarne, a new prior of Lindisfarne was required, and Cuthbert was chosen as the man for the job. Going into a very distressed situation where the community had really been torn apart by the controversy. And once again, we see Cuthbert in his role as peacemaker. And Bede tells us how he dealt with the recalcitrant monks of Lindisfarne.
Some of the monks preferred their old way of life to the rule. He overcame these by patience and forbearance, bringing them round little by little through daily example to a better frame of mind. At chapter meetings, he was often worn down by bitter insults, but would put an end to arguments simply by rising and walking out, calm and unruffled. Next day, he would give the same people exactly the same admonitions, as though there had been no unpleasantness the previous day. He was wonderfully patient and unsurpassed for courage in enduring physical or mental hardship. Though overwhelmed with sorrow at these monks' recalcitrance, he managed to keep a cheerful face. It was clear to everyone that it was the Holy Spirit within giving him strength to smile at attacks from without.
So, the difficult monks and Cuthbert's strategy. He continued at Lindisfarne, and presumably peace eventually reigned, for the next 11 years. But during that time, he increasingly experienced a call to solitude. There's a little island called Hobthrush Isle, just off Lindisfarne, and he had the practice of retiring there for some days, still very close to the island, and he would also go up into the Cheviots for times of retreat. But he eventually decided that he was going to become a full-time hermit, and he was going to retire to the Inner Farn. I don't know if you know the geography of the Northumbrian coast. Holy Island is not where the monastery was. It's not a true island. It's reached by a causeway, which is flooded at high tide. So it's still quite accessible. But a little further down the coast, there are a group of islands called the Farne Islands, which are little more than just knobs of rock sticking out of the sea, with a lot of seabirds nesting there and some rough vegetation. And it was to one of these islands that Cuthbert retired. It has a little cove, so you could put... They used boats that were scarcely more than coracles. How they... It's quite tough, the North Sea, at times, so they were quite bold boatmen. But that's where he went. First of all, he had to cast out the devils, which occupied the island. And then he had to find water, and water miraculously sprang from the rock, fortunately. And he wanted to support himself in the tradition of St. Benedict. And he first planted wheat and nothing happened. It didn't grow. And he said, if I can't do this, I'm going to leave. And he tried again with barley. And this time the barley grew and flourished. And so he had his means of support. The other thing to say about the Farne Island, topographically, is that it sits a few miles out to sea, immediately opposite what is now just a village called Bamburgh. Bamburgh at the time was the royal seat of the kings of Northumbria, and they lived in a great fortress there. So every morning when the king of Northumbria got out of bed and looked out of his window, he saw the Farne Island, and he saw the solitary, well, he didn't see the solitary hermit, but there was that witness of St. Cuthbert in his face, as it were. So although Cuthbert chose a solitary life, it was not a withdrawal. It was still a witness to the kingdom. And he still received many visitors. He built himself a little oratory. He also built a guest house. And monks still came and visited him. People came for his advice. Although increasingly, he started to withdraw. He'd been on the island for 8 years when there was a crisis in terms of the bishopric of Lindisfarne. It was quite a political post, and it was decided by universal assent that Cuthbert was the man for the job. And emissaries were sent to the Farne Island. No, no way, hermit. Then the king himself, an Archbishop Trumwyn, from York, sailed out to the Farne Island and with many tears and entreaties begged Cuthbert to come and be the Bishop of Lindisfarne. And he relented. And it's said that Boisil, way back, had prophesied to him that he would be bishop and that he had been hoping to pass this one by. But it came for him. So for having been a total solitary, he became one of the most important religious and political figures in the country of Northumbria, and travelled enormous distances. We hear of him down in Whitby, over in Carlisle. He was 50 by now, so he took on this very arduous role of bishop. And our next extract gives a little flavour of some of the things that happened during this time.
When the king led his army against the Picts, Cuthbert set off for Carlisle to speak with the queen, who had arranged to stay there in her sister's convent to await the outcome of the war. The day after his arrival, the citizens conducted him around the city walls to see a remarkable Roman fountain that was built into them. He was suddenly disturbed in spirit. He leaned heavily on his staff, turned his face to the wall. Then straightening himself and looking up at the sky, he sighed deeply and said almost in a whisper, "Perhaps at this very moment the battle is being decided." A priest standing nearby burst out imprudently with, "How do you know? Do you not see how strangely disturbed the air is? Who can fathom the judgments of God?" He hurried straight back to the queen and spoke to her in secret. "Tomorrow morning at daybreak, leave in your chariot for the royal city. Enter quickly, for perhaps the king has been slain. Tomorrow I have been invited to a neighbouring monastery to dedicate the chapel. But as soon as the dedication is over, I shall follow you."
So we see Cuthbert very involved with the royal family, with what's going on. And indeed, the king had led a very rash expedition against the Picts and his army was wiped out. And Cuthbert did have some sort of second sight. There are many stories about him foreseeing what's going on. So he served his bishopric and only 2 years later realised that he was nearing his death and he determined that he would return to the Farne Island. And when he was leaving, one of the monks said to him, "Father, when will we see you again?" And he said, "When you see me dead." And so it proved. I've just forgotten what the next one... Oh, yes. So in Bede, there is a very long account of what happened during the death of St. Cuthbert, because one of the monks who was actually there was still alive and was able to tell... It's quite an extraordinary story. A storm blew up, so they couldn't get out there, and he was left for 5 days on his own. And when they came back, he was still sitting where they'd left him, and all he had eaten during that time was 3 onions that he happened to have. He was an extremely ascetic man, and that was a time of... He had quite a tough death, really. However, they were with him at the end, and when the breath left him, immediately they went out and lit a beacon to inform their brothers at Lindisfarne. And here's our final extract about that.
"Never forget that if you should ever be forced to make the choice of two evils, I would much rather you left the island, taking my bones with you, than that you should be a party to wickedness on any pretext whatever. I went out at once and announced his death to the brethren. One of the monks went without delay and lit 2 torches and went up to high ground to let the Lindisfarne brothers know that Cuthbert's holy soul had gone to the Lord. The brother in the watchtower on Lindisfarne, who was sitting up all night awaiting the news, ran quickly to the church where the monks were assembled for the night office. As he entered, they were singing Psalm 59. O God, thou hast cast us off and hast broken us down. Thou hast been angry, and then thou hast had compassion on us."
And they took the psalm as being an omen of what was to come. And those words were remembered 200 years later. So that brings us to the end of the story of Cuthbert. And I'd just like to take a few moments now just for us to have... I'd like to invite you to have a couple of moments of just quiet reflection, considering these extracts, and to see what you feel has struck you particularly, or any of those stories that has made an impression on you. So if we could just take a couple of minutes quiet before we carry on to the next part. Avi wants another story. I mean, there is a very famous story of Cuthbert, and it is, I think it's in, there is a stained glass of it, isn't there, in Durham Cathedral?
I know it's from Beaton.
Okay. It's lots of the stories of St. Cuthbert are about animals, because they were very close to the natural world, these people, and Cuthbert loved the natural world. And there's one story that was told by a monk that he saw. And again, we actually know where this happened, which makes it so very concrete. There's a place called Coldingham, just north of Berwick, north of Eyemouth. And St. Ebba's Monastery, nunnery, was up there. And he'd gone up to visit the nunnery. And he was observed going down to the beach. It's a lovely little bay. He was observed going down to the beach late at night. And the monk saw that he entered the water and he stood in prayer all night, up to his neck in water, in the North Sea. And when he emerged from the water, two otters sprang from the waves and came to dry him with their fur. So it's a very lovely little Cuthbert story. But he was astonishingly ascetic. I mean, they really... they took the model in Celtic spirituality, who was the Desert Fathers. Mm. That's where that tradition came from, and that astonishing asceticism. Mm. Yeah, I mean, just living in Anglo-Saxon Northumbria would be pretty ascetic for us. but they went that extra distance.
What about the stories of the ducks?
Ducks? Well... specific duck stories.
What, the ones who gave up their dam?
Yes, that's right. That's actually more of a legend about Cuthbert than a specific story. There's a very cute one, if we're on animal stories, and this is a lovely story. When he'd grown his crop of barley, he came out and found the crow. Oh, no, it wasn't the barley. It was he thatched his cell with barley straw, and he came out and the crows were on the roof pulling out the straw. And he said, "What right have you to take what my hands have made? Be off with you." And the crows went away and they came back with a large lump of lard and they laid it before him. And I don't know if you've ever seen crows do this, but they do this thing where they go down, you know, they yes. flutter their wings, and they abased themselves before him and offered him this lump of lard as an apology. And apparently he was able to grease his boots with it right through the winter. So, you know, but there is this sense of a relationship. Of course, you know, if you're alone on the Farne Islands, you would feel very close to the birds and animals around you.
In a farm in particular is very frequently visited, and it's from sea houses, it's a frequent stopping point. And it's, you know, a huge place of birds.
It is. Just,
huge numbers of all kinds. Mm. And you cannot but be aware of the birds if you're in a farm. And also on Lindisfarne itself.
Yeah.
So, as I was contemplating, I said, my neighbours here, you know, in response to your invitation, what hit me was the bird sound outside.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Yes, yes, because we have nature all around us here too. Yeah, wonderful. Anything else before we press on? So it's a lot of talking in the afternoon. Are we okay to press on? Okay. So it's fast forward now by 200 years, and we have a different source this time. And our source for this is Simeon's History of the Church at Durham. This was written actually in the 12th century, or was it 11th century, 12th? And at least 200 years after the events it described. So it is, even if we think Bede might be an unreliable witness at times, this is a long time later, and this is the stuff of legend, really. And not a great deal is known about the period I'm going to talk about now, because during this period, the civilization of Northumbria was lost in real terms. The first raid on Lindisfarne from the Vikings came about 100 years after Cuthbert's death, and it sent shockwaves through Europe, because Alcuin, writing to the King of Northumbria, said no one thought that this could happen. There is a background to this, which is that Charlemagne, King of the Franks, really declared war on the pagan nations and behaved extremely brutally to the pagans. And there are records of him having captured many hundreds of men, had them forcibly baptised and drowned. And the raid on Lindisfarne came not that long afterwards. So there is a history. Yeah, and it may not have been an accident that Lindisfarne was, you know, it was a rich target, because by that time there had been many gifts to the monastery, and it was a rich monastery. But the choice of Lindisfarne as a Christian centre may not have been so early religious wars. The raids went on for the next 100 years or so. And the whole story of the Vikings and the Danish invasions is a long one. And for some time, the focus of the Danish invasions was around the Orkneys. The Norse wave of invasion went round the Orkneys and down the west coast, the Isle of Man. They set up a trading centre at Dublin. It was a very important Viking-Danish trading centre, and Norse and Danes fought over it all the time. The raids went on in the UK, well, I shouldn't say the UK, the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. But what happened in, let me get my dates right, in 867 was something of a completely different order. Three Danish brothers, the Ragnarssons, put together the biggest army anyone had ever seen, the Great Summer Army. And they invaded Northumbria. And they didn't come for pillage. They came to invade and take over the kingdom. And they wanted to create a trading route from Dublin in Ireland across Northumbria to York. And their ambitions didn't stop there. The Battle of York was fought on the 20th of March, St. Cuthbert's death day, by a curious coincidence. And they defeated the King of Northumbria. They moved down, they took East Anglia, they took Mercia. So the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of Northumbria, the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of England, were falling one after another, till the only kingdom left was Wessex. And that's where we sort of join up at this point with King Alfred. King Alfred was crowned in 871, 4 years after the Battle of York. So we are right into the thick of the Danish invasion.
Just a matter of interest, are we in Wessex now? I think we are, aren't we?
I think you are, yes. Yeah. So I was asking about Chippenham, actually, because yeah. Which was a bit south of you, yeah, but I think you are in Wessex.
We are in Wessex.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. While they moved off, so they've conquered Northumbria, they installed a puppet king in York to rule over the Northumbrians. And the kingdom, it's worth knowing, it was divided into two sub-kingdoms, Bernicia and Deira. Bernicia was all the bit north of Newcastle, basically, up to the Forth and Edinburgh. And Deira was the bit that they were more interested in around York. The good farming land and the port of York was very important to them. So anyway, just bear that in mind. While they were away trying to capture Wessex, the Earl of Bernicia fostered a revolt in Northumbria, and they went down to York. They got rid of the puppet king, and Ruxiger, who was the Earl of Northumbria, declared himself King of Northumbria. And this meant that Halfdan Ragnarsson turned round and came back up to Northumbria, and this time he wasn't interested in making friends with the natives. He came to ravage the land to teach them a lesson. His boat sailed into Tynemouth, and they destroyed the convent at Tynemouth. And at that moment, the monks on Lindisfarne knew it was time to leave. And they picked up the coffin, and they set off. And during that time, Northumbria had been full of monasteries, and almost all the monasteries of Northumbria were destroyed by the Danes during that time. And with the destruction of the monasteries went the written record, because the monasteries were the centres of culture and civilisation. And this was really true through all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. And no one in their right mind would have wanted to be a monk at that time, because monks were prime targets as slaves. Slavery was a very important part of Anglo-Saxon and Norse society at that time. So the monastic culture of Northumbria really collapsed. And this makes it all the more extraordinary that we have in our possession the Lindisfarne Gospels and these relics of Cuthbert. It is a quite extraordinary survival. And the men responsible for that survival were seven of his followers who carried the coffin during the very extraordinary events of the next 7 years. During that time of crisis, the presence of St. Cuthbert became extremely important. We learn that... I'll just backtrack a bit. At one point, the monks thought they would take Cuthbert's body down to Wessex because it was a safe haven. It was the only Christian one left. At that moment, just as they were about to leave, the Danes fell upon Alfred at Chippenham and defeated him utterly. Alfred was left with next to no one and fled into the marshes at Athelney. It really did look like everything was lost. The monks tried to take him to Ireland. Cuthbert was not keen to go to Ireland, and they were shipwrecked. So you have this time of intense turmoil going on when it really looks like it is going to become a Danish pagan kingdom. At the turning point, when Alfred is trying his comeback, the night before the battle, Cuthbert appears to him in a dream and instructs him how he is to win the battle. And when Alfred is triumphant, he has no doubt whatever that he has done this under Alfred, under Cuthbert's guidance. And for the next many generations, Alfred's family continue to send precious gifts up to Cuthbert's tomb. Meanwhile, back in Northumbria, Cuthbert visits the fleeing Archbishop Bishop of Lindisfarne, and again in a dream instructs him that a Danish slave has to be found in the village of Whittingham, and he is to be crowned the King of York, and he is to give Cuthbert's people the whole of the land between Tyne and Weir as their own possession for perpetuity. And somehow, extraordinarily, out of all this destruction, this is what happens 7 years later. That what Cuthbert has done is to create a buffer state between the north part of Northumbria, Bernicia, which the Danes are not really interested in, and the southern part, Deira, which has York, which is what they want. And in between those two, between Tyne and Weir, is created a buffer state that is to be the land of what were called the Hallever folk, the holy folk, the people of St. Cuthbert. And this Danish king, Guthred, duly grants the people of Cuthbert the whole of this territory to be theirs in perpetuity. And it is an astonishing and miraculous outcome. And that chunk of land became an autonomous district right into Victorian times. It was the Palatinate of Durham that was a self-governing church territory right through to Victorian times, the land of the Hallever folk. So at this time of intense crisis, I think we can say that St. Cuthbert saved England. This is an exaggeration. And, of course, it's taken from this account. But I find this such an intensely interesting story that I decided to write a book about it. And just for the last part of this, with your permission, I'll read a few extracts from the book. The book is a fictionalised, it is historical fiction, and it's a historical fiction writer's dream, because there is so little known. So there are very few facts to get wrong, and much to make up. So it is a fictional account, but nobody knows what happened. And I hope it is a reasonable reconstruction of what might have happened during those 7 years, based on what Simeon tells us. So the first extract I'm going to read is the leaving of Lindisfarne, this critical moment when the monks said goodbye to their island. And you may remember the bit in Bede, where on his deathbed he commands them that if you go, take my bones with you. And that's what they did. The names are tricky, I'm afraid. They're Anglo-Saxon names. I have used these because they're used in Simeon. But they take a little getting used to. So our hero is called Stithard. He's one of the youngest of the monks carrying the coffin, and the bishop and the abbot, respectively, are Eadred and Adwulf. Very similar and very muddling and very Anglo-Saxon. So the Danes have come into Tynemouth, they've sacked the convent, the bishop of Lindisfarne has taken the decision to order the monks to leave Lindisfarne. The morning is crisp and clear, with a first frost on the marram grass and a skein of geese overhead. We're taking flight like the geese, thinks Stithard, stumbling in the loose sand. His heart lifts with excitement. At last they are moving. After all the turmoil and terror of the last few days on the island, the tide is already receding. And there will be time enough for the crossing, even with this great company. When the journey is underway, the saint's coffin will be carried by cart, if the tracks allow. But for the leaving, Bishop Edwulf has ordered the saint to be carried with full processional honour. We are not creeping away like thieves in the night, he says. We will leave with God's praises on our lips. So all the brothers at the front are chanting, and the altar cross is carried before them. The coffin is borne aloft behind, followed by a long straggle of the lay people, with their carts and possessions and children. If we are to die, Stithard thinks, at least we will die all together, with the saint in our midst. He cannot look around him to look out to sea for the longships, as everyone does now at every minute. For the coffin sits heavy on his left shoulder and presses against his cheek. He cannot turn his head or look down or do anything but keep step with his fellow bearers. They are six, with the seventh to walk ahead and guide them. The sand is wet now, sticky like mud, with sudden soft patches that send the bearers lurching to the side. The coffin shifts on their shoulders and then rights itself. How strange it feels to be so close to the saint. There is only the wood between the saint's bones and his. Stithard's heart beats with unbearable gladness. Seven brothers will carry the saint when we are travelling. It is forbidden to any man else to touch the relics. The brothers chosen are Hunrid, Edmund, Leofric, Stithard. When Stithard heard his own name, he was so shocked, so astounded, that he could pay no attention to the remaining three names and had to ask Hunrid later. Franco, Chilfrith, Felgild. Hunrid tells him, did you hear what else the bishop told us? Stithard is not sure. He said that he had put all the names of the brothers before the saint, and he believed our names to be chosen by the saint. We must not take pride from it, and we must be prepared to suffer hardship. Yes, he had heard that. They must be ready to suffer hardships that could not be foretold, and not to falter. Yes, I heard that, and that you are to be the leader of the bearers. Hunrid nods without commenting. He is a quiet man who seldom expresses an opinion, who never gossips or argues. Better him than Edmund. Whenever Edmund comes into Stithard's mind, he pushes him out again. He's ready for any hardship, any trial. Except Edmund. His foot lands in a long trail of wet seaweed, which tangles round his boot. He tries to kick it off without rocking the coffin, but it is wrapped fast. Behind him, Leofric grunts at him to keep steady. He'll have to keep going till they reach the mainland and then rest the coffin. He doesn't care. Nothing matters now. They're leaving the island, and he, Stithard, has been chosen to be one of the bearers and protectors of the saint. Everyone will honour him. He will be a deacon, at the least. If he could only tell Alric, his joy would be complete. And so they continue on. And in the first stage of their flight, they're on their way to Carlisle. They've been put under the protection of the Abbot of Carlisle. On their way to Carlisle, they have an unexpected happening at a village called Whittingham. I'll just flick through and find. When they reach a village on their first journey, they lay the coffin down so that people can come and pay their respects. And on this morning, a woman comes with a slave. Slaves were very common in Anglo-Saxon society. This one was more unusual. It was a Danish slave who must have been captured in one of the early raids. And his owner, a woman, asks if he can bring the slave to the shrine. Blessings on you, mother. Is he your slave? Yes, father, I have brought him to pray at the shrine. Is he heathen? He's a Dane, father, but I have taught him Christian ways. Mother, you're good to him, but he must not come near the shrine. I beg you, father. He takes fits that throw him on the ground, till his teeth lock and he falls unconscious. For sure there is a devil in him, which only the saint can cast out. He is a good boy, father. He serves me honestly, and I dare say if the devil were cast out, he would be a good Christian. Hunrid's uncertain. He prefers to keep to the rules, but this situation is not clear-cut. He knows there are special dispensations when travelling, when lay people can approach the saint. The woman has faith. He decides it would be wrong to deny her and beckons her to approach. She pulls the youth down to his knees beside her and bids him kneel close to the coffin while she prays. His hair is very light, almost white. Stithard watches curiously. He has seen Danes before. Traders bringing their ships into harbour at Lindisfarne selling furs. But not like this. Not living alongside his own people. Anger starts to rise inside him. Why don't they kill him like the heathens killed the sisters? Why do they let him live? He thinks. He glances at Hunrid, but his face shows no expression. Then a shudder goes through the Danish youth. He cries out in his own tongue, and his body stiffens so that his head jerks upright for a moment. Startled, Hunrid moves forward swiftly. He makes the sign of the cross over him and starts to recite prayers. After a few moments, the youth slumps sideways onto the ground, as if lifeless. Stithard is seized with a sudden moment of terror. But somehow his murderous thoughts have killed him, have placed the evil eye on him and caused his death. He starts forward, but Hunrid waves him away. "Fetch Fanko," he orders as he turns back to his prayers. When they return, the youth is stirring. Fanko goes forward and takes his hand for a moment and feels his brow. He wraps the blanket around him and turns to the old woman. "He'll be cold now, mother. We'll take him back to your hut, and I will give you herbs that he must take when he rouses." "Bless you, father, bless you all. The devil has sprung out of him at the good father's prayers. I saw it with my own eyes. The saint has taken pity on him. His name? It's Guthrid, father, or so he told my son. He's hardly more than a boy when he brought him here." The old woman talks on. Hunrid nods to Stithard to help Franco carry him to his hut. Stithard feels a spasm of revulsion, but obeys. The Danish youth is heavy like a drunken man. He has an animal stink of sweat and fear. They lay him on the straw, and the old woman covers him with a pile of blankets and furs. She brings some ale and bread and leaves him sitting at her table while she hurries off to tell her neighbours. Stithard gulps the ale and stares at the Dane. He turns to Franco, who sits beside him. Franco has been a physician for many years now, and he is not easily surprised. "Is it a miracle, Franco?" "God be praised, I believe so in my heart. But it is too soon to tell. He must be without the fits for a few months before we can be sure. We will tell the villagers to send word to us at Carlisle, so that it can be verified." "But why him, Franco? Why a Dane? Why did God not save the nuns? And yet he heals a heathen Dane." Franco hesitates. "I cannot say, brother, I cannot say. I have been a physician for many years, but I cannot tell who God will heal or who he will take. We may not tell his purposes." He pauses again and quotes the prophet Job for his young brother. "Shall he that contends with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproves God, let him answer it." And later on, we're to find out more about this Danish slave and what the purposes might have been behind this meeting. How are we doing? One more short one? We'll just have one more short one. This is apropos of Cuthbert's sense. Cuthbert made it very clear where he wanted to be. There was a lot of discussion about where he would be buried. He wanted to be buried on the farm, but he agreed in the end to be buried on Holy Island on the condition that they took his bones with them. And there is, of course, many of you may know, a very famous story about Durham. His body, they'd fled once again to Ripon, and they were going back to Chesterley Street, which is where they'd ended up. And the cart just stopped and wouldn't move. And it was clear that the saint did not wish to return to Chesterley Street. And the horse would only move when they moved off to Durham. And it was at that point that the shrine of Cuthbert moved from Chesterley Street to Durham, where it currently is. And in Simeon's account, the same thing happened. When the going got really tough in Northumbria and they were starving, they decided they'd go to Ireland because there were lots of monasteries in Ireland. And it was clear that he did not wish to go to Ireland. And so this is just a short extract, stealing a little bit from Durham's story. The coffin is tightly secured. They're about to embark the body. The coffin is tightly secured, wrapped and rewrapped in leather and cloth to keep it watertight. The brothers lift it into the cart, and the carter calls, "Come up!" to the horse. The horse is motionless. "Come up!" shouts the carter again, impatiently. The horse doesn't stir. The carter curls the whip down its back, and again, and again. The horse tosses its head, but will not move. A couple of men move forward and tug at the bridle, but the horse backs away from them. The carter jumps down to look to his horse, to pick up his feet and see if something is amiss. He gives his ears a rub and pulls him forward by the bridle. The horse moves a pace or two to please his master, then stops again. The carter looks around, mystified. I don't know what's taken him. He's as willing as he could wish. Something's scared him somewhere. He stares around to see what might have scared him. Stithard feels his own feet fixed to the ground with dread. He glances at the others. All their faces are tense. It is a bad omen, and everyone feels it. Edmund breaks the spell. If your horse is a heathen, Master Carter, why, we will carry the coffin ourselves. Come, brothers. Impatiently, he waves them to join him. Eager to avoid the ill omen, they hurry forward to help him. Opening the back of the cart, they slide the coffin out and onto their shoulders. The weight of the coffin bears down on them so that they can barely support it. Even Edmund's knees buckle as he staggers sideways. Roderick starts forward to help them, but Hunrad shakes his head. For only the bearers may hold the coffin. They move forward unsteadily. And now the coffin seems to weigh on them in a different way. Each of them feels an unbearable oppression of spirit. No one speaks. The walk to the harbour seems to last forever. And they do manage to board the coffin, and they suffer a shipwreck and are washed up at Whithorn, the great monastery of Ninian in Galloway. Mm-hmm. And that's the next phase of the story. And that brings us just to the end of the story and the reading. And perhaps to think about what St. Cuthbert in his story might have to say to us in the 21st century, 14 centuries later. When I was thinking about this, the fact of the survival seems to me a very extraordinary thing, that in that time of such upheaval, the fact that we have the Lindisfarne Gospels, we have his cross, his Bible, is a very extraordinary thing that feels like a sign of the way he has survived through into our century. And his shrine, of course, is at Durham. If you've been able to visit Durham, it is now a very plain shrine that just says Cuthbertus behind the high altar at Durham. One of the interesting things about Durham, when I was younger, the shrine of Cuthbert was not much talked about in the best Anglican tradition, because Anglicans didn't really do saints. And of course, at the time of the Reformation, the shrine was swept away. All the accoutrements that had been so precious to pilgrims were taken away in that surge of rationalism, which may have been well justified. There may have been much superstition around it. But interestingly, what's happening in Durham now is something rather different, that Durham now actually proclaims itself as the shrine of St. Cuthbert. And the shrine is paid much more attention, and there are masses held there and prayers during the day. And people have started to go to Durham again to visit the saint. I was talking to a friend about this, and she said that her son had been at university in Durham, and he was going through a particularly difficult time, both with his studies and personally. And she didn't know what to do about it. And she said, all she could think of to do was to take him to see St. Cuthbert. And so they went to see St. Cuthbert, and she asked St. Cuthbert to look after him. And she felt that that had come to pass. It's difficult to say why a saint of so long ago should still be there for us, to help us and to look after us. But it is a feeling that we do have. And perhaps that this relationship with Cuthbert is something that we can only know in the heart, to know what our connection to a saint might be, to someone who has participated in the divine nature, and in that sense is no longer bound by time and place. And the disposition of the saint that we see in Bede's account of him as a man who was there for his people still seems to be true for us today. And there still is a sense of Cuthbert as the great saint of the North. This weekend there is a festival going on called the Fire of the North, celebrating three of the Northumbrian saints, St. Ebba, St. Aidan, and St. Cuthbert. And on the 4th of September, which I've only newly learned is the second of St. Cuthbert's feast days. His first feast day is the 20th of March, which is his death day. But apparently in Durham Cathedral they celebrate a second feast day on the 4th of September. And this honours the transferring of the relics from the church, the small church at Durham, into the cathedral, into his shrine. So the, what do they call it? The elevation?
Translation.
The translation, thank you. The translation of the relics. So on the 4th of September, we celebrate a second St. Cuthbert Festival, and bonfires will be lit on Holy Island and right up the coast as they were on the day of his death. So I think it's for each of us to find out what St. Cuthbert might mean to us. But for me, he certainly is a presence of compassion in our northern kingdom, and God willing, through the rest of the country too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I've talked for a long time now. Any questions?
So when I last visited Durham, I was aware of the shrine, but I wasn't aware of his relics, the Bible, his personal. Where are they? Are they there?
Well, apparently, when I saw them, they yes. were in the British Library.
Okay.
Last summer they had a big exhibition in Durham of the Lindisfarne Gospels, and lots of associated things were brought up then. And I don't know what's gone back to the British Library and what's in the Durham Museum now.
The Little Gospel of John is in the British Library.
Okay.
And it's very often on display in their treasures room. You can just walk in free and just see it.
And the oratory that's currently on in a farm, is that...
Thank you.
Does that bear a relationship to where he had his place?
Yes, it does. They think that, you know, there's a sort of tower.
Yeah.
There's a church, which is quite a lot later. I think it's 13th or 14th century. The tower is probably on the site of Cuthbert's little oratory. But it, you know, he built it with his own hands out of turf and stone, so it hasn't survived. There was a tradition of having other hermits on the inner farm. Other hermits did go and live there.
What there is the story, because of when the Reformation was happening, that people hid his remains so that the reformers with the zeal of the neophyte will not destroy them, and that in fact the place was kept, you know, their actual place is kept by the few, and what we are visiting nowadays is a sham. What can you...
Okay, my source for this is a little book called St. Cuthbert's Corpse, which goes through the known openings of the tomb.
Oh, it does?
Yeah. It was opened 3 times by the Normans, because at first the Normans didn't, after the conquest, they didn't rate this obscure Anglo-Saxon saint. When the coffin was opened, he was still incorrupt. It's likely that he was mummified in some way. He was starving at the time of his death. He was then buried in a waxed shroud in sand. So he probably was mummified. And when they opened him, and the Normans were thoroughly convinced, all the bishops had to have a look. It was opened 3 times and then it was shut. And they built Durham Cathedral. You know, they realised this was the real thing. It wasn't opened again till the Reformation. The story we have here, it's quite difficult to know how that operation could have happened, because in order, they destroyed the shrine at the Reformation, the sort of superstructure that went over it, which was lifted up with a sound of bells, and there's all these descriptions of this amazing spectacle of the cover being lifted, and all that was destroyed. Underneath is a huge slab of masonry. And they got a blacksmith in to lift it up. And he took a first hack into the coffin and saw that he had hacked St. Cuthbert's arm. And at that point, freaked out and wouldn't do any more. And I think they all freaked, really. But the coffin was taken out at that point, and it actually just stood around in Durham Cathedral for 2 or 3 years, according to this guy, before it was reinterred and the stone was put back on top. It is difficult to know how the monks could have spirited a body away, given that there was an extremely heavy chunk of masonry and it took a blacksmith and several men to lift it to get to where the coffin was. So it's a good story, but it seems to be apocryphal. And when it was last... I think there was an opening... there was an opening when it was... I think it was carbon-dated, and the remains were consonant with a man of his age of the 7th century, rather than the... You better read this. It's full of detail, and I better not say, because I'll get it wrong. But it tells you the story. By the time... because the Victorians had a good look too. Everybody wanted to have a look. And by that time, it was just bones. And fairly tumbled about, because of course they've got King Oswald's head in there as well.
Yeah.
And they may have popped in a few more saints. because there was a time in the late 9th century when there was a resurgence of, am I right, 10th? Just before and after the conquest, there was a resurgence of interest, and men went to the ruined monasteries and dug up whatever saints might have been around and brought them in to be revered as relics. And so we don't know who got popped in alongside. But we can feel fairly sure that St. Cuthbert is there, actually.
Feels like.
Is there any relationship between the building of the cathedral and Cuthbert? Or was he popped there because the cathedral was there?
When the monks moved to Durham, a church was built, of normal Anglo-Saxon type church. And
at Durham?
At Durham, right. Yeah. So there was a church at Durham with St. Cuthbert in it before the Norman conquest.
They built that church because of Cuthbert?
Yeah, because they were going back to Chester Street And there was this incident that made it clear he wasn't actually going to go back to Chester Street. And then, but, I mean, another rationale for it is that Durham is an extremely defensible site. Mm. And the reason why they were on the move was that once again they were on the run from Danish invaders. That's why they'd gone to Ripon. And an earl of the time helped them clear the site and built a fort there. So it was a good move in defensive terms to put put the shrine there. It depends which account you go for.
I can't remember who the cathedral is dedicated to.
To St Cuthbert and the Virgin Mary.
Brilliant.
Yeah. There's always been, a strong connection between the Virgin Mary and St Cuthbert.
There's this unbelievably incredible statue in there, the Virgin at the moment, this wooden sculpture, which is I recommend anyone to go to.
It's the same sculpture that did the...
Fenwick Lawson.
He's an extraordinary artist.
Yeah.
Because in the church of Lindisfarne, I went in there a year and a half ago for the first time, and they have the same sculpture. They have the six monks carrying the coffin. Mm. But I didn't know this. I knew about it. I saw pictures of it. And we walked in. I was totally unprepared.
Yeah.
And it's so alive. There is such a presence, you know. Mm. When I read your book, I kept seeing them like this.
Oh, yeah.
I highly recommend. If you just go to it. There is a website. If you search on St. Cuthbert and coffin burial.
It's also...
It's an extraordinary image, and it's so powerful.
It
the
is.
Church was not very well lit.
Yeah.
No.
I'm very sure.
Yeah.
It's very well done.
It's a big sculpture.
They've also got it in a shopping precinct in Durham, which is really... That's a shock of a different sort.
So no one's made a film yet.
Actually, Arthur Martin did suggest, and he suggested a cast for it. Which is very funny. Yes.
And at one time, Ralph Austin tells that in one of the times that they exhumed him, that they got him out, they discovered that whoever died in the previous, they put new vestments on it, and they were of silk. And that the silk came evidently from the Middle East, Abyssinian silk, with Arabic inscriptions on it. Have you heard anything?
Well, I think that happened. The 11 years after, when they opened it for the very first time on Lindisfarne, Bede does say that they put new vestments, and I think the silk would have been put on at that stage.
Yeah, because people didn't realise that Northumbria had like trading connections going to the Middle East. You know, you think about it somewhere.
Absolutely. I mean, there was this extraordinary golden age of Northumbria where it really was, in a sense, at the heart of Europe. And they were going to and fro to Rome, and there were all sorts of scholarly works going to and fro. And the monks at Jarrow did an amazing whole Bible for the Pope. And for ages this was thought to be... I can't remember the name of it, this... Do you remember?
I can't remember either. No.
It was thought to have been a European production, and it came from Jarrow. Very sophisticated.
I wonder, because you talk about Cumbria Lawson and Winchelbert, first thing that made me realise it's a much bigger place than Northumberland is now.
It is, yeah.
It seems to include Yorkshire. You set up Edinburgh?
It went up as far as... There wasn't an Edinburgh much at the time. Mm. But I discovered just the other day that... there's a St Cuthbert's church just below Castle Rock in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And apparently Cuthbert had a But they say he had a little tent there, which seems unlikely. But, you know, so he went that far. So the Kingdom of Northumbria went up to the Forth.
Yeah.
Right over to Galloway, because Whithorn was part of Northumbria. Mm-hmm. Then Cumbria was a bit separate, and it went right down to the Humber. So it was a huge kingdom, Northumbria.
I hope he reveals himself in a dream to Mr. Summer and tell him to lay off. you should really all be crazy. Not splitting my people.
Yes. Actually, there's a chap, I can't remember his name, he did a series on TV about, you know...
The MP.
It is a natural kingdom, in a way, Northumbria. Mm-hmm. And the split... between the borders is not a natural split. And it's true when you live there. It's going to be very odd for us if they suddenly become a foreign country.
I was interested when you said, I think you said, didn't you, that when he accepted the abbacy that was Melrose, that he was it was within the Roman tradition rather than the Celtic tradition, the monasticism. Is that, did you say that? It seemed to me that he's joining the two traditions.
Yeah.
And that's, an essential point.
Yeah, Melrose at that time was within the Celtic tradition. The Northumbrian monasteries were mainly Celtic, although St. Paulinus had come up sometime a few centuries earlier, but that had got lost a bit.
Yeah.
But the southern half of the country was mainly Roman converted, and the Synod of Whitby was really the critical resolution when Northumbria went Roman, basically.
But he would have been brought up
in the Celtic tradition. Yeah.
But then have accepted.
I know. That's what's so interesting about Cuthbert. It is a really wonderful thing about Cuthbert that he did marry the traditions. Which some of them refused to do, Coleman and the others left at that point. But yes. I think there is quite a lot of sentimentality around the Celtic tradition. It's felt to be sort of a bit more cuddly and not so hierarchical. But it was just different. A different society.
It's obvious that it seems obvious he took the wider view. There are some differences.
That's right.
There is a wider ecumenism, which is more important. But the way he dealt with this, he didn't just push an idea. I mean, the way that the passage you read about the way that he was with the recalcitrant monks, it wasn't like he said, this is the idea of greater Europe, that's what we must do. No, it's not like this.
No.
It's just being with them.
Yeah.
It's a completely different view.
I think it's one of the moving things about that time that it was a matter of persuasion. People weren't kind of enforcing stuff. And the king brought them together and let them all have their say. it's very interesting.
There's something I wanted to ask, because I've long wondered about this, and it's kind of peripheral, but Anglo-Saxons, because it's all you expect, all the Anglo-Saxon kingdom, the period, I kind of would have this picture that these were pagans, of the whole Anglo-Saxon tradition we know about, and the ship burials and all this kind of stuff. You mentioned that most of the land was pagan, in fact, and that Cuthbert and his people were responsible for converting this area, largely, and so on.
Well, Aidan was the first in, but yes.
Yeah, okay. So there was is this what happened? There was a gradual kind of change over. The Anglo-Saxons got in, but then the English gradually became Christian. Is that the kind of way it went?
Say again?
Was it a gradual movement? For example, Wessex, you talked about Alfred and this, so on. I mean, was that pagan?
Well, we're talking Alfred's 200 years later.
Oh, good point.
And Alfred really, really pushed education because he felt, that monasticism was dying, really.
Yeah.
He was quite extraordinary, Alfred, in all sorts of ways. There's just a really nice little bit, actually, about the pagans laughing at the monks. It's about the monks are coming down. They're trying to get some wood down the river, and a wind blows up and blows them out to sea. Giving up hope of human aid, they fled to the divine. While the rafts were floating out to the sea, they came out of the monastery and prayed fervently to the Lord for their brethren who were on the point of perishing before their very eyes. The rafts floated... Oh, yes. Cuthbert was standing on the opposite bank of the river among a great crowd of peasants, okay? The rafts floating out to sea looked like five birds bobbing up and down on the waves. While the monks opposite were watching in sorrow, the peasants began to jeer at their way of life, as though they deserved such misfortune for spurning the life of the ordinary man and introducing new, unheard-of rules of conduct. Yeah. Cuthbert stopped their insults. Do you realise what you're doing? Wouldn't it be more human of you to pray for their safety rather than gloat over their misfortune? So, you know, you have this going on, that there's the peasants saying, resenting what's happening in this new way of life. So it's very much a dialogue at this point. Mm-hmm. And of course the peasants, the Lord changes the wind and blows them safely back to shore. And Cuthbert says, "See." And so the peasants fall on their face. And, yes.
Is your book available on Amazon?
Yeah. It's available here if you're interested.
Downstairs.
Yes. The Venerable...
I wonder if you could say something about writing the book, just briefly, what it was. Imagining the characters.
Well, the characters are taken from the account given by Simeon. He does actually mention by name five of the bearers, and one of the interesting things is that he also talks about how their sons are honoured, and you think, hang on a minute, and their descendants are honoured, and you think, funny, these were monks. And so I did feel at liberty to introduce a little romance later in the story, just to give it a little human interest. It was a matter of... I'm not sure what to say about it, really. What is there anything particularly you wanted to know about?
Not really. I mean, I very much enjoyed reading it.
Good.
It certainly brought the story to life very well. The characters were well brought to life really well.
Great. I mean, for me, I work best with a structure, and there was a very clear story here, and that's... It makes it easy in a way, because you've got your plot. Although this plot did need a bit of sorting out, because we have to think of a way of why the slave gave all this land. So there was a little bit of tinkering to be done with the plot.
Did you invent this healing business of the young Dane?
I did.
Well done.
Could have happened.
Excellent.
It's tricky because it was in the account. It's completely miraculous. You know, you just hear that the bishop has a dream of Cuthbert. He says, "Go and find this boy and crown him King of York," and that's a bit tricky, you know, just to put over. So I had to backfill a little bit.
You did it very well.
And I think one of the things is in the way I've done it is that, in fact, it was a political manoeuvre on Eardred's part, because he could see a way to use the boy. And the bishop doesn't disapprove of this, because God's will works out in many different ways. And I think that was the point I wanted to make, really, that, you know, miracles come in different forms. And they don't necessarily come as deus ex machinas. Mm-hmm. but through the way of things. And that politics could be part of that too. Don't tell Alex Salmon.
But it was a most remarkable solution.
Well, it was. Given that, you know, they were just on a sort of laying the land waste just a few years earlier, it was extraordinary. But I think the Danes, although they were pagan, but they still were in awe of a very holy man. Of, you know, there was sufficient magic and power around a figure like that for the Danes to have respected it. Perhaps, I don't know, who knows.
Well, thank you very, very much indeed. That was fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, you know, this is our pre-run of the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which starts in about a month. The author will be signing her book.
No.
If anyone would like, either has one or would like to buy one, Michael will be...
Bead, yeah.
Venerable
Bead. Sorry, Bead.
We'll take the pennies.
Bead will be downstairs.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming along and listening so patiently.
Fantastic. Thank you. Very much. Thank you.